Hello and welcome to Lush. My name's Andrew Payne and you're listening to Origins, the program that asks musicians, artists and makers where and how it all began, their creative processes, the music that inspired them and why they continue to make and create the work that they do. This week we speak with award-winning journalist, Louder Than War boss and musician with the Membranes, John Robb.
So I remember watching Hard Day's Night on Christmas, the TV, 1971, and it just seemed amazing. I remember that was quite a big thing, watching that.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me
seems so much fun, and it seemed exciting. You see, that's the life you want, isn't it? Like, yeah. It was the energy and the speed of it. And the early Beatles, when you listen to their records, they're so joyful. It's a sound of people thinking, oh my God, we can change the world with a song.
Yeah.
You know, when they scream on their records, nobody screams on records now, but the Beatles scream all of their records. They're screaming more than the fans, and it's a scream of unfettered excitement. Went to my granny's in Selkirk, in the Scottish Borders, that summer, and I bought a Beatles picture book in the newsagents. I thought, oh, that's that band again. We had no idea they were massive. It was just utterly naive, you know. And that became, we used to read it over and over, and the way they morphed and changed all the time was fascinating. And then about 1972, we started watching Top of the Pops more, and then it got really into Blockbuster by Sweet. That was a really big record.
Does anyone know the way? Did we hear someone say?
We just haven't got a clue what to do.
You know, people go, New York Dolls, man, the guards, but the Sweet, you go, they're the same thing.
Yeah.
They're both wearing the same kind of clothes. New York Dolls wear those outfits because Overend Watts wore from Mott the Hoople wore the boots,
true.
And they copied him. You know, nobody can ever believe people from Hereford or the Sweet, from where they came from, could actually be influential. Oh, no, New York, or we have to kowtow to New York. We were doing it anyway, you know.
Yeah.
But so then school, you go to school, you go to main school, 1972, 71, when we went to bigger school,
yeah.
From primary school now. And that's when pop culture hits you in a wave, isn't it? Because everybody's come from other schools, everyone's got their own thing, and it becomes a very important defining thing, doesn't it? Yeah, I wanted to make music, but I know I had to do. My sister could play a recorder, but it sounded horrible because I didn't realise recorders are actually quite a beautiful instrument because.
Yeah, when it's played well.
Everyone used to play them really badly. But in the 1970s, no one had a guitar. No, you didn't know anybody had a guitar. It's one kid. And this is what's quite interesting, actually. This kid, who I found him, when we played with Hawkwind in March, I hadn't seen him for 40 years, and he's at the gig.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, I've met you again. How weird is that? And his brother used to write songs on the guitar.
Yeah.
He's a massive Bowie head. And he'd recorded all his albums on cassettes, which he made for himself, which is pre-punk, pre-DIY.
Mm.
And he made about 30 albums of all songs. And we go, how do you do that? And we couldn't work out how he did it. How do you play guitar? How do you write songs? It's completely mind-blowing in that. And he was a big Bowie fan, and he got us really into Bowie, but not in a cool way. Again, we had no idea that Bowie was cool.
Yeah.
Like, Diamond Dogs was his favourite record, and he had the original cover, you know, the controversial cover, and we thought, what an amazing piece of artwork and that. You know, so that's the only person I knew who had a musical instrument. So it wasn't like, I wanted to be in a band. So we used to get cigar boxes, put rubber bands on them, which I'm actually thinking about doing again, because you can get these kind of weird little droney sounds
Absolutely.
Out of them. And that. So it wasn't until punk came along that it actually made us realise you could actually make music yourself. I used to think people from outer space or London made music. I had no idea that people in Blackpool were allowed to make music. In 1976, I was actually reading the music page from 74 because I was waiting for the Beatles to reform. So they always have stories about them. We're going to reform next week.
Yeah.
And there's the only place you couldn't read about it in the national papers. It wasn't a Daily Mirror or anywhere else. Music wasn't written about. It wasn't taken very seriously by the mainstream press. You thought, what are these weird papers? The Melody Maker had 140 pages, massive, wasn't it? But 2 inches thick, and it was all the ink came off your fingers. And they tell you stuff about that, and you think, oh, it's got other things in as well. It's got stuff about the glam bands. This is you can actually read about this stuff. This is interesting. Yeah. So I've been reading newspapers from 73 onwards, you know, intermittently, more and more and more and more. So I was reading about the punk thing, and I had no idea what it sounded like because you couldn't hear it. Mm. But you saw the pictures of the bands, and you imagine what they would sound like in your head. And when I heard them, they actually sounded like what I'd imagined. Obviously not exactly, but the idea, because it was very linear and stripped down, the pictures.
Yeah.
I kind of guessed it was kind of fast, stripped down glam rock or whatever. So the first time I heard it, we used to go skating. Look, I'm from Blackpool, right? So this is what you did when you're 15 we were.
Yeah.
You go to skate rink, it was rough as well. So people think skating would be quite poncy. Not in Blackpool, it wasn't. They had a thing called the Mad Dash at 9 o'clock, where everybody go around as fast as possible. If you fell over, you'd be kicked in the head by skates. There was patches of blood on the ice.
Rollerball.
It was like that. It was super rough. It was scary. You know, we were only 15. There's big, hard kids there, you know, like proper hard kids there. Like, Blackpool's pretty rough around the edges, you know. It's not, you know, and we're standing there going, oh my God, there's no way I'm going out there. So we used to go there. And Mott the Hoople was another total love of mine. I absolutely love Mott the Hoople. Yeah. You know, that was probably my favourite band before punk. They're, you know, everything about them. My best mate at school was a massive Mott the Hoople fan. He'd bring the albums round. I thought, God, the albums are as good as the singles, you know. Mm. All the way from Memphis, the moment we saw it on TV, it's, whoa, what a rush. It was amazing. Because it was a bit like English wrestling, British wrestling, you know, that thing where they don't have the gear, so the mothers made the outfits for them. It was so homemade looking. And then it turns out that Overhead Watts had bought a pair of women's boots and somehow forced him his feet into them and sprayed his hair with silver car spray to get the silver hair. And it was homemade. And I met him years later after the Mott the Hoople gig in London. And I went up to him and I heard he was notoriously grumpy, but I thought, I've got to speak to Overhead Watts because he was like a god in our world when we were about 3 or 4. He looked cool.
Forgot my six-string razor. Hit the sky. Halfway to Memphis before I realized. Well, I rang the information. My axe is cold. They said she rides a train to REO.
Line the song goes, and Overhead's a rock and roll star. And he looked amazing, didn't he? So he said, I tell him, I'm going to go over there. This is going to be heartbreaking. He's going to be a twat. I went up and said, Overhead Watts, I have to shake you around. I loved you when I was a kid. And he goes, John Robb, isn't it? He goes, I absolutely love it. He goes, wow, I love the Membranes. The Membranes are a fantastic band. But you've got to remember, I have really weird music taste. And it's like, whoa, oh my God, I was gobsmacked. I couldn't think of anything to say. I thought, Overhead Watts likes my band. And he had these little nooses around his arms. And I go, that's the Monks, isn't it? I get where you're getting those from. He goes, oh my God, you know yourself. And we got on really well. And he had his pair of white shoes on with Ima on one shoe. He'd written on felt tip and Wanker on the other. And he was the coolest guy ever. And we became email buddies and email for ages. We were actually going to do a song together. Wow. But then he had throat cancer for about 5 years, so he kind of dropped off a bit. But I've kept all the emails, really long emails, you know. Yeah. I had a total mutual respect with him. He said, I love everything you do, and I love the way you just kind of do your thing, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, God almighty, this is Overhead Watts, isn't it? Like, and he said he never rehearsed a lot when he did the comeback thing. Right. He got the bass off the wall after 24 years, went up to the first gig and played it. But I mean, to want a better phrase, he was a total dude, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I love them. So I was already warmed up for punk. So we go skating. Yeah. One night they played Anarchy. It's just the beginning, the descend of chords.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's like you're going down into hell.
Yeah.
And it's still to this day one of the most incredible records ever made. It's an art piece.
Because I wanna be, yeah.
It's a brilliant pop record. It's a great rock and roll record, but it's actually a weird, heavy, odd record. People was going, they still couldn't play, did this and this and this, but no,
they they could play. That's the point.
This is the one thing that Mark McLaren's theory trips up over. He stumbled on one of the greatest rock and roll bands of all time. he can take any four people and I'll make them to stars. They weren't any four people. This is an insanely talented band. You know, Paul Cook's a great drummer, Glenn Matlock's a great songwriter, Steve Jones' guitar sounds insane. And then you put Lydon on top.
Great front.
And that voice. Oh my God, I didn't know what he looked like. I just hadn't seen a picture of him staring like that. And it's like, wow, it's mesmerizing. Like, but I had no idea if he's a singer or not. You just look at pictures and papers. And I was captivated. But then I thought, but then you read about the punk thing. You see, like, that's what hard, cool kids are into. It's like, we can't, we're not hard, we're not cool. How can we be punks, you know? I mean, you couldn't go out and buy punk clothes. So
to make your own.
Yeah, well, we didn't know how to make clothes. So it took about another 6 months when I worked out to take in trousers by stitching the inside legs. And I did that for about 10 years, taking in trousers for secondhand shops and stuff like that. We got, that's about, probably about 78, we started getting into D-mob suits, which actually weren't even D-mob at the time. They were like flared suits in the 70s. Wedding suits, we used to have pinstripe trousers, just take them in and out. So I'm your classic post-punk person because I think post-punk was basically all the nerdy, idiots like me, up and down the country, were completely captivated by punk. And trying to make a version of it where they wouldn't get beaten up, which you did all the time. And on your own, not on your own terms, like a defiant thing, but you had no idea we had no idea how to make it, so we made our own version. That's what we were. Because it's funny, because I know all the original punks now, you know, the original 50. They're all my mates, and they've still got this very good thing about being cool and that.
Yeah.
But I say, I'm not hampered by that. I don't care. It's just something resonates with me. I'm into it. I just jump in with 2 feet. I've always done that and that. So jumping into punk in Blackpool in 77 or whatever was not easy, you know. There's either really cool hard kids into it. There weren't many nerds into it.
So it was a bit of a commitment.
It was a commitment, yeah, because you're basically wrecking your life. You know, I could have had a really good job. I could be really comfortable in a nice big house in the suburbs, but I didn't even want that. It resonated with me because I didn't want that comfortable life. I wanted to be like a pirate, have adventure, but I was too nerdy to go and do it. And punk gave me the excuse, you know. Everyone I knew were just like nervous people, you know. Like, it was rough.
Yeah.
You went out, you would get beaten up, and it was, the 70s were gloomy, weren't they?
Yeah.
And not everyone's like dead hard and dead big, you know. Punks weren't. But the great thing about punk was it gave all the kind of the introvert kids a voice, and suddenly you were empowered, you know. To me, that's the powerful thing with punk. You had all the stuff inside you, and now you could get it out. My life has never changed since then. The day I got it, I've just done the same things every day since then. Like, listen to music, go, wow, that's amazing. Like, you used to tell your mates, you've got to hear this. Then you start doing fanzine, and you're telling people, you've got to listen to this. Then you start writing, you say, got to listen to this. Then you start going and telling you've got to listen to this. It was the same process. It never really, my life,
and
in a tragic
on.
Way, has never actually really changed.
It's carried on from 17. Baked and barred, sometimes I admit I even stole. The worst crime that I ever did was playing rock and roll. But the money's no good. Just get a grip on yourself.
I guess a lot of the stranglers in, because once got the stranglers, I remember a kid at school lent me Grip.
Yeah.
And then he lent me Ratus, that he came out. And I love, I heard Grip, thought Grip was amazing. And then he came into school and he just bought Ratus. And I looked, and the cover's amazing. The Stranglers fans hate the cover, don't they?
Mm.
They go, he's got makeup on. You know, funny, aren't they, Stranglers fans? But I was thinking, this is the weirdest looking group I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You can't get, we all say this when we see the Stranglers, we say, you can't get four more unlikely people into one room. You know, you got Bunnell's up front, he looks really cool.
Yeah.
He looks like a psychopath.
He does.
He looks dangerous. Dave Greenfield just looks weird. Jet Black, what the hell is this? The beard standing there, who looks really surly, like he's going to start a fight.
Yeah.
You think, what? And then you got the stuffed animals at the top looking down. And the picture's a great picture because it's really well composed because everything's kind of side going down and down and down. I still remember I first saw them. It's kind of how I first saw it. You look at them and go, oh, that's really weird. Oh my God, look at the bloke at the back with a piece of plastic tube, you know, like that. Hugh Cornwell's at the back, and he looks really cool. It's almost like Clint Eastwood cool. He looks really, and they all look really dangerous, don't they?
Surly. You wouldn't mess with them.
And then you listen to the record thing, and it had a rat on the back, and I've always been massive into nature. This is my little joke with Chris Packham, like, he was into, we're both into punk and nature, and he made a great career out of nature, and I made a dismal one out of punk. But somehow he, you can tell he always wishes he was in a band, and I go, no, you did the right thing, actually. So, and they resonated with us because they were not cool, you know. So we thought, well, that's actually okay. They're not cool. Like, we're not cool either. We're quite scruffy, so this is good. And I always liked psychedelic music. I didn't know much about psychedelic music, but I like music that's twisted. Yeah. Maybe because of my Beatles thing. I'd heard a lot of the Beatles psychedelic stuff by then. And when the Stranglers are very psychedelic. So we didn't hear the Doors till after the Stranglers because my mate was a hippie. There's a lot of hippies in Blackpool, so we got to know them in 78, 79, a lot of Hawkwind heads and that. But this is before all that. So the Stranglers were our portal, our opening to all the sort of music and stuff. And the record's brilliant. It's genuinely aggressive. A lot of punk records were kind of angry, but they were kind of squeaky angry, you know. When you hear the Stranglers, it just sounded surly and angry. That's what you felt like when you were 16. And it wasn't that long after we started going to Magic Mushrooms, then it totally made sense. We kind of gone within a year of being kind of nervous little kids into Magic Mushroom fiends, you know, like, so it's funny how that jump goes really quickly, isn't it?
And how did the membranes get together?
Well, like a lot of bands that time, you actually formed the band before you'd ever played an instrument. It's funny when I speak to people that period, if I speak to Andrew Eldridge, he formed the whole concept for Sisters of Mercy before he'd ever made any music. So he even designed a t-shirt before he'd even played a gig or written a song. And the other person I always think about is Hookie. When I interviewed Hookie, he said, the story about when the Rolling Stones had asked him to join or go for shortlist, Bill Wyman left, and he said, I really want to do that, but I can only play
Hookie
basically one string, and he plays it absolutely beautifully. And he loves the Stranglers as well, actually, that's his band. I mean, Hookie's like me, we're just really uncool people, but he found a way of being very successful at it. and he said, I can't play any covers, I couldn't play a Rolling Stones song to save my life. And that's what we were all like. Mm. We would just pick up instruments and go, how the hell? We tried to learn Peaches for 3 months, we just couldn't do it. And then we worked it out, and it's like, And then we go, oh God, I can't bother with that. I'm gonna play my own song instead. So you just play the A string, no. I quite like the sound of an A string just played on its own for ages. No, let's go. And it sounded great. And that's why the punk was the lead instrument, the bass was the lead instrument post-punk, because it's the easiest thing to play. Mm. That was what the appeal of it. And on one level, because Bunnell basically reinvented it, it's the lead instrument, the Stranglers, you go, everyone loved that sound. You go, what is that sound? It's the most beautiful, perfect sound. It's heavy, it's melodic, it's rhythmic. It's a great sound. And it wasn't just blokes. I mean, blokes go, Stranglers, just a blokes band. No. Like, most of the women I know love the Stranglers. Yeah. And I know they have some pretty dumb sexist lyrics, but women go, it was so exaggerated and gross, the women just thought it was funny. I mean, a lot of the women I know are a bit tougher, you know, they're not soft people, you know. If the Stranglers had tried to be sexist with them, they'd have just punched them. They wouldn't have run away to court or anything. They're proper women. So the bass been reinvented, and then because it's the easiest instrument to play, with guitar you had to learn chords, but the bass you could just do one string and just go up and down the frets, so you'd have a solo. The bass is key, and then the bass is the key instrument post-punk. And I always argue this, because of the Stranglers and because it's the easiest instrument as an intro instrument, that becomes the instrument choice to write songs on. So post-punk is all about the bass guitar. It's a lead instrument. So when I go to studio now to this day, and with the Membranes Ultra mix at the moment, bass guitar, still in the middle. That's where the tune is. Guitar, so you have to explain this to guitar players a lot. No, don't play. Just play there, just play a little bit. Don't play too much. Just go down, down, stop. Wait, back in. Because the bass is playing the riff. You don't need a guitar playing the riff. You make a weird noise, play against me, on it, off, stop, you know, like that. And that's what post-punk was. Although we have no idea at the time. So guitar player just go, tonk, and the bass go, dong, and to me, to that day, that's the best music in the world. You know, that running bass, guitar making weird percussive noises against it, you know, and that was going, you know, even bands like Neubarton, I can hear all that in there, you know, their second album, the bass playing the lead. And then it turns out that Alexander, who's a musical director, Neubarton, Black and White, Stranglers, his favourite album, and he learned drums along to that, he told me all that. So that was when the bass went to Woolworths, bought a £30 bass, a Walrus K bass because all the money I had.
Yeah.
The guitar player went to a second-hand shop in Portland Refiles. We bought a guitar with four strings on it. We didn't know they meant to have six. And then we played our first gig a week later. We'd never been announced before. So we plugged it in anyway, and it's all out of tune because we couldn't tune up. All right, there's no tuning machines. So everything's out of tune. We put the machine heads in a row on the guitar because I thought that's what you did. So it's like, we used to rehearse my mum and dad's record player. So I think the guitar player's dad, because he was a bit kind of handy, he built a lead. He made a lead, which he plugged into a record player. And that was our guitar lead. And the bass, I would lean on it to get the resonation. The guitar would make a scratchy noise and that. The drummer bought a 10 quid kit and he's only 13. And we played our first gig and of course it was all over the place, you know. And I think in a weird way, that's kind of formed the sound that went on forever. I don't really care, things are in tune that much to this day, you know. You can still, a lot of those people at that time, that they have that same mindset, you know, all my favourite singers don't sing in tune, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that important. It's just, if you sound like you own the song, you own the song. And I wanted a violin bass, because Captain Sensible had a violin bass, and also the Beatles connection. So I thought, but you couldn't buy a violin bass in Blackpool. So I got a bit of wood, and I carved it into a violin shape, and took the neck out of the Woolies bass and put it in there. And by mistake, because it was maple wood, which has got a lot of resonation, I had no idea of this.
Yeah.
It had amazing sound. So when I actually got an amp, because someone said, I had to buy a bass amp, but I got this amp, which I still got to this day. I don't use it because it's blown up, but but I put the bass in it, it just went, bang! It's like, whoa, what amazing sound. It was just the heaviest sound ever, with no pedals on it. And that's how we kind of basically constructed the sound, you know. So there's a period of time, 83, 84, we had the heaviest sound in the world, you know. We were the heaviest, most out there. But we had no idea that we were. We weren't trying to be, just how it came out. Then in 81, we put a single out. And it was a single week in sounds. Yeah. Did a single called Muscles, and John Peel played it. And we sent John Peel a copy, like he did, and he played it. And we go, oh my God, this is amazing. We're actually going to play in the radio.
Yeah.
We didn't get a session or anything, but... Then it was single a week in sounds. We never sent them a copy. And I remember you could get the music papers, you read them on the way home, walking down the street like people do, look on the phones now.
Yeah.
And you'd be flicking through them, oh my God. I don't believe it. It was single of the week. How did that happen? I was the one who's on the phone all the time. Yeah. Like, the rest of the band never did it.
And not mobile phones, either.
No, a call box.
Proper call
box. My dad put a lock on the phone, so I wasn't allowed to use the phone at home. So I had to go in the call box in Anxholme Lane with the drummer, nicked all his washers from work, which is the same size as a 10p piece. So we'd be pinging these in, and some nights it'd be full and you couldn't get any more in. So you had to go to the one about half a mile away up the road. There wasn't like loads of them. Middle of November, pissing rain, absolutely freezing there. But I took a compass so I could write the phone numbers on the window, scratched him in. So it'd be like somebody's number, blah, 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 written on the wall. And that was my address book. And I know it's pathetically amateur DIY.
This is kind of romantic, this whole...
But this is how it was. You know, that was my office. It was a call box. You have to wait for everyone to get out of the call box. Yeah. You go in, people banging on there, going, no, wait a minute, I'm trying to get hold of John Peel. I knew it's always going to be pushing a boulder uphill. We had no idea of how to make anything commercial.
Yeah.
We wasn't like we weren't anti-commercial. It was something we loved pop music. We'd grown up with pop music, you know, like Sweet or Motley Hoople or Beatles or whatever. And Sex Pistols, Clash, Strangler was a great pop band. So we just didn't know how you made that kind of music. We had no idea at all. You know, it was just coming out the way it came out, like all bands. You know, you try and do one thing and your fingers won't let you do it, will they? They just come out in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
But to me, Spike Milligan's was a pop song. It was just a bit...
It's a great pop song.
Yeah, it's so invigorating. You know, when I want to listen to it now, I remember it. Actually affected us was the sound of the storms come off the scene, and that was in our sounds, the wind whistling off the promo. You could hear all the time, and we always thought that Spike Milligan's to me sounds automatically totally that sound, you know. Going to bed at night, you could hear it. I was 100 yards off the sea. We never went to the beach, the whole year never went to the beach, we only lived 100 yards from it, and it was always cold, and you could hear which is in all our records. It was always like that, the dark, gloomy, sort of rainy, stormy nature things, always in the music.
Always there.
Yeah, always. See, the next album's about nature and that. And it's got a lot of that in there, but it's something we've always done from day one, you know. It's always, subconsciously, it was in there. We kind of were very aware of it, you know. We'd try to record it on tape recorders, get it into the tracks and that. We're always thinking about it and that. Yeah.
Going. What is it about music that just keeps you moving, keeps you going? What do you continue to get from it?
It's the thrill of ideas, isn't it? And with the bands, it's the idea, isn't it? And you just think of a little idea in your head and think, I'm just going to pursue this till it works and that. So the reason we do double albums is we have a lot of ideas. There's tons of ideas, you know. They're not this. It's not. It should be a triple album, really.
So you still get excited about making music and finding something new?
Oh, God, yeah. I go through all the agony of mixing it.
Yeah.
And it's not like, I know Steve Albini going, oh, you're recording it like this and you're recording it. You don't mix it, you just record it straight. And Shellac, amazing records. In fact, Shellac, in a way, I think they're a descendant, they're cousins, aren't they? They got the sound that we were messing about with in 84 and took it to absolute perfection.
Mm.
I'm not saying they copied us. I know Steve was a fan of the Membranes. Mm. He's been spiked me to Terry Corner. But I'm not claiming, oh, well, he obviously copied us. But that bass-driven, discordant guitar, desiccated rhythm thing, that we were kind of pioneering in a way, I think. You know, if you actually look at the dates when things come out,
yeah,
he's made it to perfection. You know, their records are amazing. But I'm not a scientist. He's very scientific the way he makes records. I can't do it like that. What we tend to do is we jam them out in the studio. I'll come up with an idea. We work it up. We don't even work it out. We just play it. A lot of waving hands around. No, stop. No, that. No. And then I spend about 3 months of hell editing it down and mixing it. So it's not like with Steve's got the mics. He's got a great studio, perfect mics. It's right in the first recording. We can do it back to front from him. And I know it's not the way you're meant to do it.
No.
It's just the way it is. And I've learned to accept that's the only way I'm going to be able to make this kind of stuff. Can't rehearse it over and over.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel right to me. We just do it, edit it, that's a bit out, move it there. And it's kind of fake, but it sounds amazing. You know, it's not... I know the pure way of making music, it just comes out and it's right the first time, but we don't all have that luxury now. And then I start getting loads of other ideas as well. I can't make it simple. I think it can't be guitar, bass and drums. I've got to have a choir on there.
Mm.
Because I saw a choir in Estonia, went to Tallinn Music Week. I was with Viv Albertine, actually, because I was in conversation with her. And I said, do you want to go see any bands tonight, Viv? And she's not really into new bands and that. But I said, there's a choir. Let's go and see a choir. They're going to sing Estonian folk music. You've got to come to this. This sounds amazing. She went to see it. And after I said, we just sounded like, that was absolutely amazing, wasn't it? Like, I said to her, I'm going to work with these. And she's going, no, I'm going to do that. And I go, no. I went up to them and said, conductor straight to the gig said, we've got to do a gig together. And she goes, I'm really up for it.
Yeah.
So then we did. About 4 months later, we did one in Estonia. And the woman who puts Tonic Music, we put the gig on, did a great job of it. With the film, with the choir, it was stunning, you know. And I went over to 2 weeks before to show them the songs, and that's quite a weird experience. Stand in front of a choir, 40 women, amazing voices, and they go, you walk in and go, okay, so how's the first one go? And you have to go, well, it's kind of grunting away. And she plays it on the piano, and the choir sing it back and go, oh my God, that sounds amazing, you know. So it was all melancholic drones with that kind of East Europe, well, Scandinavian kind of gloominess in it. And that's the choir, but it's not a gospel choir, it's more that kind of vibe. Couldn't bring them over to Britain, it was too expensive, so I just put on Facebook, I need a choir. And Claire, my current choir leader, conductor, said, I'll get you a choir of BIM students in the BIM college, which is about 2 minutes where I live. So we just use varying different choirs. Every time we do a gig, it's a different choir. But she's conducting, she's amazing, great to work with. So we've done, on this album, put loads of choir parts in there, because I don't really want to be a straight down the line rock band, you know, four blokes against the world thing. I know it's four blokes in the band, but I never look at it as a set band. It floats a bit, you know. If there's a 20-piece choir on a stage, we're a 24-piece band. Sometimes we'll have two drummers.
Yeah.
Sometimes we'll have a keyboard player. I like spinning it around all the time. Sometimes we tour Europe and the guitar players can't make it. I bring another one and he'll say, what do you want me to play? And I go, that's up to you. Yeah, I mean, if it's wrong, I'll say stop.
Stop doing.
Yeah, just drop it down there, you know. But I've had some really good guitar players, but they get the concept. They understand how the music is made and that. So it's
so it's still very much punk ethic, isn't it? It's kind of DIY.
Yeah, it's DIY. But we know what we're doing now. We can make the record sound really good. The new album.
Yeah.
The sound of it's amazing. I put the tracks on. I go, oh my God, I'm onto this. Actually, really does sound good. The last album. We've actually got it right. And this album, I'm thinking, oh my God, we jumped about 100 miles further on. It's just, I've got the bass the way I want it to sound. The drums are simple and tight and rhythmic. The choir bits sound amazing. We're rule breakers. We're doing everything in reverse. Most bands get the good work done first. We're doing it last. I wish we'd done it first. I could have had 30 years of just playing the hits. Like.
Have you moved the machine heads yet?
Yeah, we've worked it out how to tune up and out. But sometimes it's good to have it detuned or just hit the guitars a bit to metal. Or, I mean, we still operate outside the rule books, you know. Yeah. I mean, the closest bands to us are bands like Neubauer, really, you know. The deconstructors, the renegades, you know. People say, where's the chorus? I don't know, it doesn't need a chorus.
No.
It's just, I like songs that have one riff, most of the album, each song. I was just thinking the other day, I didn't even notice this. I just play the same bass line for 5 minutes, one end to the other, really repetitive, you know. It's really hypnotic, isn't it? It just really pulls you in. And then it's up to the way the song's arranged. You just build up levels of different things. So we've got one new song, What Nature Gives, Nature Takes Away. Starts the bass, then we've got a string section comes in, then a choir comes in, then I'll do my vocal. And then Pete put this amazing Ebo on it. It's so melancholic. There's that, then the choir comes in. It goes up and up and levels and levels and levels and levels. And we drop down just back to the choir on its own. And it's like, it's really effective. Yeah. I think we kind of fit outside genres, but there's bits of us that fit inside as well, you know. I mean, it's a problem really, balance out. People always say it's great if you have your own thing going on and your own sound, but it makes it really difficult because everybody likes you have to get them one by one. Yeah, every festival you play, you're slightly out of sync with the rest of the festival. Yeah. But in a sense, we're probably post-punk more than anything.
Yeah.
That kind of time where you were inspired by punk, but you did it in your own version of it and things. I would say we were punk, but people's idea of what punk is different from what we are, you know.
Yeah.
So it's all that kind of weird stuff. So in New York, we perceived to be sort of kind of hip, you know. But in this country, we're just bumpkins from Blackpool and that. You know, which is stupid, isn't it? I never thought that about music. I don't care about all that stuff. Does it connect? Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening. And if you'd like to hear more from Lush and our ever-growing archive containing interviews, debates, comedy and stories with a wide range of charities, organisations and individuals, please download the free Lush Player app, which is available for both Android and Apple.